film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. This show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. We got a full show today. Yes, the music you heard, it was from the film version of the musical Hair, directed by Milos Forman. A little nod and a salute to Milos Forman. We'll talk about his work on next week's show, as well as Arlie Ermey's filmography. But we have two interviews to do, one with, of course, McKenna Mays, talking with Daniel Arthur Jacobson of Public House Cinema, and then I'll be talking with Beverly Gray, the author of Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, the story, actually, how The Graduate became a touchstone of a generation. But before we get to those, don't miss Lean on Pete, the new film from writer-director Andrew Haig, who gave us one of my favorite dramas from a couple years ago, 45 Years, and the romantic weekend drama called Weekend. It's a boy and his horse, a nice understated performance from Charlie Plummer for you fans of All the Money in the World. Imagine if Flicka were written by Charles Dickens, and it's a gut punch of a movie in a good way. Steve Zahn, Chloe Sevigny, and Steve Buscemi are also in the cast. Don't miss this. We got short on time. So here's McKenna Mays' chat with Public House Cinema's Daniel Arthur Jacobson.
What is Public House Cinema?
Public House Cinema was originally a grassroots effort to bring an art house cinema to Indianapolis, started by a friend of mine and myself, Dusty Fry. And we wanted to basically do pop-up theater events of independent film, because there's not enough offerings in Indianapolis, to also bring awareness around this need and to prove that, yes, we need something downtown that you can go see an independent film 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm. So how did your partnership with Indie Fringe kind of happen?
We partnered with Indie Fringe because, well, one, they're a great venue that supports the arts and performances of all, you know, shapes, sizes. And so we had a connection with them right away because of what we were doing. So we thought it'd be a great venue to show something. Actually, it originally started because we partnered with the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library. That's right. We partnered with Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, and we showed a Vonnegut film, Breakfast of Champions, and it was at the Fringe Theater. And so through that, we met Pauline, and she was like, if you guys want to do this more, let's talk. And so that's how we're here today.
And how would you kind of define the indie film genre?
Just something off the beaten path that you wouldn't see regularly at a Regal, AMC, something that kind of makes you think, or something that's not traditional, you know, anything that's, you walk away and it makes you think a little bit more than the normal movie.
Mm-hmm. And why were you so drawn to it?
I started making films in middle school for fun, basically music videos. And then through that, I started watching more films, and I remember in high school watching, you know, Donnie Darko, and it was the first film I saw that was actually like a challenge I didn't get, and I realized how much fun it was to watch something that I didn't understand the first time. And then through that, it was just, you know, down the rabbit hole of watching film that makes you think.
Mm-hmm. I'm still not sure if I understand Donnie Darko, and I've seen it like a handful of times. So why is it so important that these films get exposure and people can see them?
I think that film is arguably the art of empathy. There's not many, I mean, all art kind of connects you to other people, but film does it in a way that is so tangible. I mean, you're in the shoes, your eyeballs of other individuals that are not like you, different backgrounds. And I think it's really important to watch that, because you walk away from a movie almost being inside someone else. And I don't know many other art forms that do it so well. And in our day and age, where it's so easy to stay on your phone or do whatever you want to do specifically, I think film's super important to get outside yourself and see what it's like to be someone else.
And how did you originally get involved with film?
I originally got involved with film because my parents are photographers, and so they always were super supportive of drawing, creating, doing things. And so my dad bought a camera, and I started putting, you know, music videos together, and they were super supportive. And so I started making stuff, and then I started absorbing film to learn more, and it just kind of started from there and went crazy.
Mm-hmm. And so your goal is to kind of create like an actual theater in Indianapolis. So where are you currently at with that?
Yeah, our actual goal was to, you know, we don't want to be popping up forever. We want an actual brick and mortar. And so through this journey of Public House Cinema, we met up with some great partners who are doing the exact same thing. They've been looking for a building, and they've finally found a location. It's in Windsor Park, and so we are currently partnering with them on the design phase currently. It's right across from the Spades Park Library, and we are basically shopping around our design, seeing what works, talking to the neighborhood, getting their feedback to see, you know, how can we best make this work for not only the neighborhood, but Indianapolis as a whole. So we're just kind of in the design phase.
Mm-hmm. And do you have maybe like a tentative date where it would be open?
Yeah, our dream is a year from now. So basically late spring, summer, 2019, it's going to have three screens right now, which is going to be great for programming. We'll be able to do first run, but then also repertory and older films. So we can do, you know, director series, those kind of things, because that's, I think, is a huge gap right now in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm. So when you guys do open, are you going to support local filmmakers as well?
Yes. One of our big initiatives will be hopefully giving, you know, opportunity for local filmmakers to show their work on the big screen. We would love to have a monthly local film night. We've been tossing around. And just a place where if you get done with a film and you want to show it to your crew, to family and friends, we want to provide a space where you could rent it out. And premiere it. I mean, that's a big dream of ours because there's so many great filmmakers right now, and there's just not a home for them to show their work, and we want to be that place.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have any favorite independent films of yours?
My favorite independent films, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou by Wes Anderson, definitely is one of my favorites. It's one of his weirder ones, but I'm in love with that one. Y Tu Mama Tambien, Alfonso Cuarón film that I saw in college that really kind of changed the game for me, I think. I still go back to that one all the time. It's a coming-of-age film, and I have a soft spot for coming-of-age films. But those two definitely, I think, are my top favorites. And There Will Be Blood, I think, is a masterpiece that's happened in my lifetime, which is exciting.
And do you remember what, like, initially made these films stand out to you?
Well, I know E2 Mama stood out because of the complexity of the simple story that was told, you know, with these, you know, vulgar kind of characters, but you saw them totally change throughout the film, but then also dealt with a lot of political issues going on in Mexico City. And so for me to watch something that dealt with, you know, a simple coming-of-age story, but also dealt with, you know, death and the political system of Mexico was amazing to see all of this wrapped up into a simple story. And so I think that is something that independent film does, is takes a simple story and can answer a lot of questions or bring up a lot of issues.
Mm. So what do you have coming up with Indie Fringe?
Public House Cinema is currently hosting, we're doing a Spectrum of Cinema residency at the Fringe. So every other Sunday we're showing films that kind of span the spectrum of genres. And so this Sunday, April 22nd, we're showing The Lure, which is going to be fun. It's a Polish horror musical starring mermaids, so we're really excited about that. It's going to be crazy. Then May 6th, we're showing The Road Movie, which is going to be also another fun one. It's all dash cam footage dash cam Russian footage, so it's just car accidents and bizarre situations that happen on the road in Russia. So that'll be come out. It'll be fun to see it with a group of people. And then we're wrapping up our residency with an Oversimplification of Her Beauty, which was May 20th, and that is directed by Terrence Nance, and it's all music from Flying Lotus. But film's not the only thing happening, because Fringe is also doing their 9th annual Diva Fest. That wraps up this weekend, so it's all women playwrights and mostly new works. And then something really cool, they're doing a 10-minute play festival first weekend of May. So emerging playwrights through the Indiana Writer Center are doing 10-minute plays back-to-back. So that's early May. So please check out indiefringe.org for all their events.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
That's McKenna Mays talking with Daniel Arthur Jacobson of Public House Cinema. Here's my epic chat with author Beverly Gray. What was your first encounter with the film The Graduate?
You know, I saw the film The Graduate when I was in college. It was a brand new movie. I saw it in one of the few places you could see it at the time, which was the 4-Star Theater in Los Angeles. In those days, movies opened small. This one sure did. It opened, first of all, in 3 theaters, 1 in L.A., 2 in New York, and then it expanded to a big 35 theaters. And by that time, it was clear that this movie was going to be big. But big didn't mean what it means now, so it spread all over the country, the 35 theaters and then a couple of hundred theaters and so on. But as the year 1968 wore on, it seemed like everybody had seen it.
And I'm going to be a gentleman and not ask, but you were of an impressionable age when you first saw it?
I was in college, but of course, you know, I started college at age 7. So,
good answer. So, what was your reaction when you first saw it?
Well, I loved it. I thought it was a lot of fun, and like most people of my generation, I didn't stop there. I saw it several times. It was always a romp, a good deal of fun. But one thing I've discovered in looking around was that there were people even back then who saw it and right away felt that it was something life-changing, that it was showing them something they hadn't thought about too hard or hadn't been bold enough to do, which was to break with their parents, break with the expectations of the previous generation, and kind of go off on their own in their own heads.
My first encounter with it was my freshman year of college, and I had a wonderful English teacher. We spent 5 classes on The Graduate.
Really?
I think it took about 3 classes to actually get the film to finish the film, and then so 1 to discuss it, 3 classes to watch it, and then the follow up, the 5th one to actually discuss it. And I wish I had more classes that had broken it down that well.
That sounds excellent. Am I allowed to ask around when that was?
Yeah, because I'm old. I don't care. This was 1988. So I was
okay,
I was 18.
The film was not a brand new phenomenon at that time.
No,
by any
but it,
of the imagination.
But as a film nerd, still prospecting, you know, it was one that was always talked about, and the images of the poster and the soundtrack, and you know, we as certain teenagers, we looked for Anne Bancroft in our neighborhood. She wasn't there. We looked. But the breakdown on it, and of course our instructor, this was his favorite film, and obviously he would point out little aspects of it, from the animal imagery to the trapped imagery to, and of course the famous final moment, which we'll get to in a little bit. But
sure.
I know at this time it had been at least a decade where there was little rumblings of uncertainty in this kind of post-World War II society. I think of something even as far back as The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, the Beat Generation in the 50s, and there was, you know, little questions, you know, questioning the status quo. And I think by the time The Graduate came out and the film year of 1967 and the music and the rise of young people, it just blew up. Is that safe to say?
That's absolutely true. Thinking back on it, there were movies that I was really too young to see, and they were movies like The Wild One and Rebel Without a Cause, and they're kind of the juvenile delinquent movies. But I think one of the things about The Graduate was it was about youth rebellion, but it wasn't about juvenile delinquents. It was about the nice kid, the upper middle class kid, the kid who was well entrenched within his culture, who just and chucked the whole thing, and that was something new.
Was your household one? You were not allowed to look at Roger Corman films or the biker movies. You know, Bruce Stern and Jack Nicholson were bad boys.
That's actually an excellent question. It really wasn't that I wasn't allowed, but it never occurred to me.
Okay.
My parents, I don't think it would have occurred to them to think about it or to think that I would be interested in such things. We were pretty middle class, but on the intellectual side, and that kind of trashy stuff, it didn't occur to anybody to ban me from. Who knew that I'd end up working for Roger Corman in years later? So I learned about that kind of movie much later than most people.
Well, you know, you can hear us dripping in the tone. We say those kind of movies, capital T, the kind that were at drive-ins and at the neighborhood,
yes.
the downtown theaters we didn't go to at night, those kind of places.
That's right. It sounds like you're the kind of person who would be ripe for the Roger Corman oof, as we say.
I got to meet Roger. He did a thing at IU Cinema, a couple of years ago. And I got to tell him directly because the first two plays I did as a play director, the first two plays had a combined budget of $200, and he was a big influence of that. So I got to personally thank him for that.
That's great. Yes, I've got a lot of stories about Roger. You may know my first book was about Roger. It's called Roger Corman: Blood Sucking Vampires, Flesh Eating Cockroaches, and Thriller Killers.
Yes.
And it's considered, I'm proud to say, the definitive biography of Roger, one that he had nothing to say about. it was an independently written biography of a very, very interesting man.
Absolutely. Going back to this a little bit, I mean, as I mentioned, I think 1967 is the year that I think cinema changed. And part of it was because of Bonnie and Clyde, and a lot of it was also with The Graduate. And then 2 years later with Easy Rider, I think the studios finally figured out that the system was broken and that teenagers bought tickets.
That's right. And that, so I got to mention Roger Corman again. He knew that.
Yeah.
Most people didn't, but he did. The indie filmmakers of that era did know that, and they were starting to make those, as we said, monster movies and biker movies and youth rebel movies. But I think the year 1967 was the year that movies that really broke with the status quo really came into their own. When they were recognized, they were Oscar-nominated. That's what made that year so interesting. If you look at the Oscar nominations for the year 1968. Now, that's honoring the films of 1967.
Correct.
It's a very different bunch. I mean, previously, the Oscar had gone to wonderful films like A Man for All Seasons, let's say, or The Sound of Music. I have nothing against those movies, but when I saw them back in the day, they had nothing really specifically to say to my life, my era, American culture. They really didn't. But in 1967, you had Bonnie and Clyde, which was a studio movie,
yep,
although the studio didn't like it much, but it was a studio movie. You had The Graduate, which was, to everyone's great surprise, the blockbuster of that year. Well, really the blockbuster of the year 1968.
Right.
Because it opened at the tail end of 67. You had other movies that were perhaps a little more conventional, but they were about contemporary subject. There was In the Heat of the Night. There was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Movies that were about race, that were about violence, that were about things that we as young people were really very much aware about. Because to remind you and your listeners, those of us who were in college in the late 60s, we'd been around a lot of stuff, but we were aware of a lot. We remembered the assassination of a president in 1963, of course, John F. Kennedy. We were very much aware of the turbulence of the civil rights movement, which in some moments seemed very positive and idealistic, and in some moments seemed very brutal and disturbing. And, of course, we were getting drafted.
Yep.
We were going off to Southeast Asia for a war that we didn't understand. So, in fact, in the year 1967, in the summer of that year, right when The Graduate was being filmed, there was a new Selective Service Act signed by Congress and the president, and it basically banned young people. They were given their 4 years of college, but after that they were draft fodder. There was no longer such a thing as a graduate student exemption, except in very special cases. And that really changed people's plans and really changed people's attitudes. These young people did not want to fight that war, didn't want to contemplate being drafted, and they were ready to revolt, and they were pretty revolting sometimes. That's the kind of background for The Graduate, a movie which, I should add, says nothing about any of that, but somehow captures the mood.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back a little bit, I know the novel was 1962.
Correct.
How was the book received at the time it was published?
It was barely received. It got very little attention. And fortunately for all of us, it was reviewed in the New York Times. You know, not a big review, just a little teensy mention. And in that mention was the reviewer sort of liked it, sort of didn't, pointed out certain things in it that were wild and crazy and interesting, like the visual of a young man in torn clothing sitting next to a young woman in a wedding gown in the back of a public bus. That, of course, being the end of the film. And that same young man in a scuba suit in the bottom of a swimming pool. And those verbal images seemed like they were would lend themselves really well to filmmaking. And the reviewer did say that he wasn't sure that the character made any sense, but he might one day be as discussed as the leading character in The Catcher in the Rye. And that was a great attraction to a young man named Lawrence Terman, who was a very, very, very minor league producer who wanted to move up in the world, and who, of course, like everyone in Hollywood, had always wanted to film The Catcher in the Rye, and thought maybe this was the next best thing.
Mm-hmm. And so then it's about at least 4 years or so before it actually started shooting. 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. The book was optioned by Larry Terman, who's still with us and has been very helpful to me. We haven't mentioned the name of my book, but I'd like to do that if you don't mind.
Please.
It's called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation, mm-hmm. from Algonquin Books, and it's been out for a few months now. It's very exciting.
I wanted to use the title as my autobiography, but again, I never met Anne Bancroft, so I can't use that. But
I actually did.
How was she?
Well, I didn't actually speak to her, but it was kind of a funny story. I was sitting in the office of my OBGYN. I was newly pregnant, and that is kind of a disorienting feeling. Sitting there in this empty office, and in walked I was browsing through a magazine with an article about the marriage of Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks, which, of course,
yep.
seemed like a very curious combination of people. And while I was browsing through that magazine, the door opened, and in walked someone who looked exactly like Anne Bancroft. And I thought to myself, gee, I knew that being pregnant would create all sorts of changes in my life, but I didn't know I would be having hallucinations. And of course, it wasn't a hallucination. It was her in the flesh. She was a beloved patient of my doctor. So as I said, I didn't exactly meet her, but I certainly saw her up close.
Well, you made the talk of the pairing. My wife and I, this year will be 19 years, and when we first got married, some folks couldn't understand the pairing, and we would just say Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, and people go, that makes sense. So, The film, once the film started getting, I have to credit The Graduate, I think, for one of the greatest non-traditional casting choices in cinema, because I know at one time folks wanted Robert Redford and Doris Day to be in the film, and well, obviously that didn't happen.
Right. Well, two different things.
Okay.
Doris Day was approached very early on. She was of interest both to Larry Terman and the new, really fledgling director, Mike Nichols, who was very, very new to directing and to film directing at that time, that thought she was a really interesting possibility because she could act, and nobody would ever have seen her in a role like this before.
Correct.
So the novel was sent to her. There wasn't a script at that point. And she has said that it offended her, and she turned it down. Larry Terman told me that, in fact, the book was withheld from her by her husband, who was also her manager and a very controlling guy, so she never actually saw it. But that's she was certainly under consideration. Robert Redford had a really good chance at playing this part. He was a young actor. He had just finished acting on Broadway for director Mike Nichols in Mike Nichols' first big directorial breakthrough, the Neil Simon comedy Barefoot in the Park, and in which he played a young husband, and of course very handsome and appealing and charming. And they liked each other. He was a smart guy. He seemed like a good choice. But as they went through the casting process, there was more and more question about whether he would be the most interesting and funny possibility in that role. And it was thought that maybe he was just too darn suave and good-looking to be as funny as it was possible to be in that matchup with a woman who was supposed to be old enough to be his mother. And there's a famous story, I don't think it's quite true, but it's a really good story, that Redford said to Mike Nichols, "Why don't you just cast me already?" And Nichols said, "Well, Bob, when was the last time you ever struck out with a girl?" And Redford said, "What do you mean?" I don't think it actually happened that way, but it's the story's been repeated so many times, it's tradition. But Larry Turman insists that he had always had his doubts about Redford just in terms of his general handsomeness and the sense of him as someone who was equal to anything, whereas they wanted somebody who didn't seem equal to anything. So a lot of people... Redford was one of the finalists. There were six finalists. Another one was Charles Grodin, who came very close.
Right.
Dustin Hoffman was certainly unlikely. He wasn't totally unknown if you were following kind of the offbeat, off-Broadway acting scene. He played odd and strange parts, usually with accents and limps and hunchbacks and things. He never played, you know, the young male romantic lead. That was not the kind of parts he went out for. But there was something interesting about him. He was offered the role just his very, during that day-long audition session with him, where he was videotaped, along, as a matter of fact, with Catherine Ross, was that he seemed awkward and uncomfortable and uneasy, and that just seemed right for this character. He was also a great deal more, as one would say in that era, ethnic than one expected a Benjamin Braddock to be. And for all those reasons, and because he was short, he had a big nose, all those things, he wasn't considered by Hollywood standards right at all. So to the point where people came up to the filmmakers at industry screenings early on and said, "This is a great movie. It's just such a shame you miscast the lead." And the consensus was that he was ugly, that he was all wrong for the part. It just didn't seem to be working, except as far as the audience was concerned, it was working like gangbusters.
Yep.
They were able to identify with him in a way they could never, I think, have identified with a Robert Redford.
As somebody who
seemed to really embody that kind of awkwardness that a lot of people had felt in their own lives.
As somebody who's 5'5 and used to have just dark hair and a big nose, he's perfectly fine, I think.
I agree. When I see the movie now, I think he's really cute.
And he was what?
Ugly was the word that was used over and over and over about him.
And he was in his mid-20s?
He was in his late 20s.
Late 20s.
Practically 30.
Right. And then on the flip side, we have Anne Bancroft playing the prettiest of all of his mother's friends, and she was how old?
They were about 5 years difference in age. He was almost 30. She was about 35. And obviously, just in terms of the logic of the movie, that wasn't going to work. But he, of course, looked younger, and she was made up to look, in fact, older than she was. Mike Nichols has said that one reason that he didn't allow her to see the dailies that came out every day, as you know, was that he didn't want her to be distressed by how he was making her look.
Correct. Correct.
You know, just the lighting, et cetera, was making her older than in fact she was. And she said something that was quite wonderful years later. She said, "When I first saw the movie, I was appalled by how horrible I looked. And now when I go back and look at it, I think I'm the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen." And I think a lot of people would agree. In fact, I think there's a fair number of people who think that she's a great deal more interesting looking than her very pretty daughter, Catherine Ross.
Well, I know for some, I've talked about this on the show, I guess the concept of the MILF, for a lot of people, it starts with Anne Bancroft in The Graduate. So
I think so. The MILF, the cougar, those terms.
Yeah, which, you know, public radio terms, of course. But at the same time, the other one I always bring up around the house, of course, was, you know, Angela Lansbury was apparently 9 years old when she had Lawrence Harvey in The Manchurian Candidate and Elvis Presley in Blue Hawaii.
Poor Angela. Well, I shouldn't say poor, because I have a great regard for Angela Lansbury.
I think
the lady can do it all.
Well,
but she always apparently looked older than she was and was playing very mature parts at a very young age.
On the flip side, of course, she had to have been 70 when she had Chip, when she was Mrs. Potts in Beauty and the Beast. So it's all relative.
Well, you know, they teapots have a long fertility cycle.
Yes, you said it, not me. So you mentioned that The Graduate was released in December of 67. I know at the end of the calendar year, so it could be considered for awards. And you said it went like gangbusters. How many times did you see it when it first opened?
I really can't tell you, but I know it was the kind of movie that you saw whenever you could. And I'll tell you a good story about Ron Howard, who is younger than I. He saw the movie for the first time when he was about 13 years old with his dad, and that may seem surprising, but he was, even at the age of 13, a very serious would-be filmmaker, not just an actor, not just Opie. And he went with his dad to see it. And you may wonder about the rules of theaters. There were no rules in 1967. The old production code had been thrown out, but there was no new system of X's and R's and PG's and so on. So at the time the movie came out, there was absolutely nothing to keep any kid in America from walking in and seeing that movie. So he did see it and, of course, saw it a number of other times. Now, this is before VCRs, but here's somebody who wants to be a filmmaker. He wants to not just to enjoy it, but eventually to study it. And even when he was filming American Graffiti, he was lucky enough that it was playing at a local theater. I think it was filmed in Petaluma, I believe, Northern California. And he and Charlie Martin Smith, another would-be director,
yep,
just every time they had a spare moment, they'd sneak away and they'd watch this movie because you couldn't just pop it into your home entertainment system, but you could try to find it where you could try to find it, and they saw it over and over and over again. And he has said, "This is the movie I went to school on," because at first just enjoying it and then looking at some of the really clever and remarkable things that Mike Nichols and his editor and his set decorator and all those people were doing to make this movie a real visual treat.
Exactly. And Nichols, of course, won Best Director that year. It was the only award, correct?
Yes.
So
yes, it was nominated for 7 Oscars. As I said, it was a very good year.
It was a rough year. It was tough.
Yeah. And it was, I always watch the Oscars, but this is the first year I really remember having a strong rooting interest. And amongst the 5, the Best Picture nominees, 5 of them, there was The Graduate, you know, that little movie that could, Bonnie and Clyde, In the Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And you know what the 5th one was?
Dr. Doolittle.
Dr. Doolittle,
yeah.
Right. 20th Century Fox, a really overblown, kind of dumb.
Not kinda.
Very dumb, yes. I hate that movie. Musical production from Fox.
Yeah.
Back in the days when people, well, I suppose they still do, but they certainly did then, wined and dined everybody and got all the, you know, the employees on the lot to vote for it.
It was a gasping dinosaur.
Yeah. It was also, to mention movies that weren't up for Best Picture, it was the year of Cool Hand Luke.
Yep.
It was the year of, the title always eludes me, In Cold Blood.
Yep.
Two for the Road. I mean, this was a great year.
Correct. I know there's a lot we could talk about as far as the directing a little bit, but if you could indulge us with the story of the final moment, which, you know, for anybody who's an actor or a director, it's mind blowing, especially by 1967 standards, and it still packs a punch today.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start with that. The ending of the movie, as in the ending of the novel, is Ben and Elaine joyously, exuberantly skipping onto this bus. She has just been married to somebody else. In fact, that was a Mike Nichols change. In the novel, she has almost said, I do, but it hasn't quite happened in the great tradition of movies and
yep.
novels like that. But in the movie, she has actually completed the wedding ceremony. She is married to this guy, this tall, blonde guy who doesn't look anything like Dustin Hoffman. And they've gone skipping out of the ceremony, leaving everybody behind, and they're on that bus clapping their hands with glee. And that's supposed to be the end of the script, the end of the movie, of these two exuberant young people heading off God knows where. A funny thing happened, and it really is a very movie kind of thing because it shows what serendipity can contribute to the making of movies. Which was they're on the bus before they get on there, and this is at the very end of filming, which, as you know, movies are not generally made in order, but this was the end of the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
These two very tired young actors get on the bus, she in her wedding gown, he in his torn clothing, all the passengers staring at them as they head to the back seat, and Mike Nichols had said to them, all right, we've blocked traffic for 20 miles around, and this is costing us a fortune, so get on that bus and laugh, goddammit. Well, with instructions like that, it was pretty hard to be jolly and carefree.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried. They really tried. They clapped their hands with glee, and they beamed at each other. And then somebody was supposed to say cut. In fact, it was one of the bus passengers was actually the film editor, Sam Osteen, who was supposed to relay the message to cut. And he never got that cue. He was never told to cut. So the camera kept rolling. The two young people on the bus, having tried to look happy and exuberant and carefree, start to get a little nervous. They look at each other in confusion. They stare out ahead. They try to smile. They can't quite smile. The camera rolls. And when Mike Nichols saw all of that in the editing room, he said, that's the end of the movie. And he has since said, this was the ending that was created by my subconscious. I didn't know what I was doing, but I guess I did. And it's a great ending because people don't agree on it, or people who look at it one way at one point in their lives look at it differently years later. So that pretty much all the young people who were cheering for Ben and Elaine, and I mean in theaters, they would explode in cheering.
Mm.
It was a very exciting ending to a movie. There was bedlam in the theaters when this happened. I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of those young people thought, yay, they've done it, they've gotten away, and they're cheering as the bus sails down the road or rumbles down the road. But even back then, some people said, well, wait a minute, what's going to happen to them now?
Yep.
Where are they going? And, boy, they have really screwed themselves up. What's going to happen? And certainly those same people, if they saw the movie again years later, would, and when they had done a bit of growing up, would think, no money and a real legal tangle, and they've cut off all ties, and where are they headed? Where does this take them? So that it's possible to see the movie as a triumph. It's possible to see the movie as pending disaster or something in between. And that makes the film a great deal richer when you watch it, especially when you watch it now.
And for a lot of us, it was, you know, this was the first encounter with now what, or what happens after They All Live Happily Ever After.
Right. That's for sure. And I think it sort of reflects what a lot of those young people were feeling about their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And one reason I think that the film is still with us, because some of the things I mentioned, like the Vietnam War, thankfully, are long gone. But getting out of college and not being sure, now that you're leaving that safe environment, not being sure where you're headed or where you should be headed or what you should want or how it's going to work out, all those things are still very much with us. You know, at Stanford University every year, at the end of the school year, just before graduation, they show The Graduate, and people really still identify.
I think all colleges should do that, really.
I think they should.
And I know, and of course, it's been 50 years since the film came out. And I know that, and we could go through, and it's in your book, Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, the myriad of pop culture references that have been influenced by this film. When did that start immediately after the film's release? When did little homages or parodies start to pop up about The Graduate?
You know, I don't think it was immediate. Although certain things were catchphrases immediately, and of course the famous one is that one word, plastics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that got a chuckle or a nudge from the beginning. But I think it was as television became more and more prevalent, and a show like The Simpsons has parodied The Graduate any number of times.
Right.
The Wayne's World movies.
Wayne's World 2, yeah.
Sort of the son of The Graduate.
Folks don't know, Buck Henry has a cameo in the Robert Altman film, The Player.
Right.
And he's in an office with the Tim Robbins character, and he actually pitches The Graduate Part 2.
Right, where Ben and Elaine are married and Mrs. Robinson lives with them because she's had a stroke. A funny stroke, but
right.
A stroke. Sadly, now Buck Henry's had a stroke, so he's not in good shape, I'm afraid.
But there's been a number of images and homages, and of course we haven't even mentioned the soundtrack by Simon and Garfunkel, which combined previously recorded stuff with new material for the film.
Right, very little new material, as it turns out.
Okay.
What happened was Mike Nichols, of course, was looking for music, and of course music is usually pretty much the last thing that you add to a movie. So as he was preparing to go on the set every day, his brother had sent him a Simon and Garfunkel album or two, and he found himself playing it over and over and realized that the voice, the sound of that music just seemed right for the movie. That something about it's sweet, it's young, it's melancholy, it's a little bit ominous. It just seemed right. In fact, William Daniels, who plays the father of Benjamin Braddock, said that when he first heard the music and realized what music was going into the film, he was surprised because it seemed to completely change for him the tone that he thought the film was going to take. Whereas I think he thought it was going to be, you know, an all-out stand-up laugh riot comedy, but it is a very funny movie, but it starts with Simon and Garfunkel's The Sound of Silence, which is not a funny song.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Right. It's ominous. It's disturbing. It's wistful. And, of course, it's featured at the beginning through that long montage section in the middle.
Yep.
And again at the end. So that's really the song of The Graduate, even though there is one song written for the movie, kind of written, because it's not even a full song. The song, Mrs. Robinson, which is funny and exuberant. Mm-hmm. But that Simon and Garfunkel, Paul Simon, was supposed to write a whole score, never quite got to it. The best he could do was this little bit of Mrs. Robinson, which started out, "Here's to you, Mrs. Roosevelt." I had no idea what he had in his head when he was thinking about presumably Eleanor Roosevelt and where that was going, but it became Mrs. Robinson, and the song then became a full-length song after the movie. If you listen to the movie, there's very little lyrics there.
Right.
But those other songs were they were used as temp tracks in the editing. And if you remember the film, there's a very important section in which Ben goes back and forth between his parents' swimming pool and Mrs. Robinson's bed. To set to Sound of Silence, Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, April Come, She Will, existing Simon and Garfunkel songs. And they were being used in the editing room as temp tracks and were very carefully edited in. And then someone had the bright idea that, well, hey, this is good music and we've made it fit. Why don't we just go ahead and license it? And the financier of the movie was very upset at that idea because it was so unconventional at the time. He said, people are going to laugh at you. You can't do that. You have to have new music. These are old songs. By old, of course, he meant 2 or 3 years, but old songs. They said, well, this is what we want to do. It's what they did. And, of course, that, too, like the casting of an unlikely Dustin Hoffman, started a new trend, and it's still with us, a trend of using familiar music, which has the advantage of conjuring up a mood. So you come into the theater, you hear that music, you immediately have certain emotional connections. That worked very well in that film. A similar thing is done thereafter in American Graffiti, and I could list scores and scores of other movies that have used familiar music to kind of rouse emotions in a new project.
I can hear the big chill nodding.
That's a good one, yeah.
I want to share with you a couple of moments that are a part of my household. By the way, so the scene where Benjamin just grabs Mrs. Robinson's breast, I think is how every female feels when a guy is near them. Or as I say, anything, you know, everything I learned about wooing women, I learned from Benjamin Braddock. The other one was when my daughter was 2 years old, we got to see my wife in a production of A Christmas Carol here in Indianapolis. And there's a in at IRT, you'll see where this is going, but she played Mrs. Cratchit, and there's this observation deck in the theater, which has a big glass window, which is perfect for little ones because it doesn't distract the audience. And when my wife started to speak as Mrs. Cratchit and Emma finally recognized her, she started banging on the window screaming, "Mommy." And I tell people,
I can see where that's going.
Yeah, I can tell it. So then, I told that story 1,000 times. And then last year, I finally showed the film to my daughter. She was 15. And she absolutely loved the film. And then when that moment happened, she literally, "Is that me in the theater?" I went, "Yeah, that was you in the theater."
That's great that she remembered that. There is a funny story, at least one funny story about that tapping on the glass. And that's one many moments that's been parodied again and again, as my book points out. And even in a commercial for an Audi, they put those things in it. Or a Wayne's World sequel, they have that scene. But they had found this very special church, and if you remember, and I'm sure your professor pointed this out, there's lots and lots of glass in the movie.
Yep.
It's got all kinds of symbolic resonance. And they found this church, an actual church in Laverne, California, which is in Southern California. They thought it was perfect, and they had to persuade the people in the church, of course, that they weren't going to do any damage. movie crews always have to persuade people they aren't going to do any damage, and they often do, unfortunately. But they insisted they weren't going to cause any problems. So they're there in the church, And Ben starts banging on the glass with his fists, which makes sense. He's frantic. He wants to get her attention. And the pastor of the church just freaked out because the glass is quivering, and he was convinced that it was going to get broken. And this is the glass of this choir loft or this balcony. And it had been the gift from a wealthy patron, and he, you know, didn't care what was going on. He did not want this glass broken.
Right.
So he said, okay, that's it. Everyone out. Well, of course, they wanted to continue filming, so they said to Dustin Hoffman, do you think there's a way you can call attention to yourself without making the glass shake like that?
And make it semi-blasphemous.
Well, they weren't thinking blasphemy. They really weren't thinking blasphemy.
I know.
But he did hold up his hands in a kind of a hands-up position with his arms bent at the elbow and tapped on the glass, and that seemed to satisfy everybody. But then a generation of angry church people started insisting that this was a he was trying to do a kind of a Christ symbol thing.
Right.
Which was astonishing to the filmmakers. They had never planned on that. They sometimes found that funny. They sometimes found it annoying because there were critical reviews that complained about this. It was not anybody's intent, but there it is.
And by the way, when you lock the door...
yeah, with a big gilt cross, right? Yeah. That raised some hackles. I mean, that was part of the reason the film got so much attention, is because it made certain people so mad.
Yep.
And there were people writing angry editorials and denouncing the film from pulpits. Well, you can imagine how attractive that made the movie.
Of course.
To a lot of young viewers.
Absolutely. Well, Beverly, again, the book is Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. This is fun to call work, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Writing,
I didn't catch that.
Writing this book, it's fun to call this work.
Oh, yes. I had a real ball working on this book. It's got me to relive a part of my life. It was lots of fun to find out not only what the movie meant to people, but to find out all the ways in which people have had fun with it, but also have taken it very seriously. There were some fascinating stories I've learned because I interviewed a lot of everyday folk who remembered seeing the movie and who felt it had changed their lives. And it's really surprising how a little comedy had such an impact on some people. There is a Chinese fellow I spoke to. He was American-born, but his parents were very old-school Chinese. Growing up in Mesa, Arizona, this very big Chinese family, he knew that his job in life was going to be to look after his aging mother in her old age. And after seeing The Graduate, he just was entranced, saw it several times, and then came to his mother and said, "Mom, I love you, but you can't live with me anymore." I mean, that was what he took from The Graduate. Just, I've got to be my own person now. I've talked to women who've seen in Mrs. Robinson not just a comic villain, but a tragic figure who is a real reminder of how domesticity can be a trap. So people have seen something important to their own lives in this movie that never started out trying to have that kind of an impact.
Actually, I have one other thing I forgot to. Have you ever seen the stage version?
Yes.
What did you think?
It's lousy.
Thank you.
Pardon me?
Thank you. Yeah, I saw it as well. A friend of my wife and mine was Mrs. Robinson in a production, and I couldn't believe that one of the greatest films about lost youth has somehow turned into a sitcom play, and it really bummed me out.
Yeah, well, first, of course, it doesn't have some of the brilliant technical things that Mike Nichols put into it, but it also, it doesn't seem to mean terribly much. And what the production seems to be anchored by, and this is what got it all the press and the audiences, was Mrs. Robinson. I don't know about your Mrs. Robinson, but the Broadway one and the London one, she has a brief second where she takes all her clothes off, so you get to see her in the buff.
Yes.
And if she's Kathleen Turner or somebody like that, that's, I suppose, kind of interesting. But Mike Nichols, who had nothing to do with the production, had a very comment about that. He said, I haven't seen it, but I can't imagine all the fuss that's being made about a 50-year-old naked woman. He said, I think most people have a perfectly good one at home.
Yeah, you do see, well, the production I saw, you do see Mrs. Robinson in everything. Strangely enough, when I was on my honeymoon with my wife, we went to London as a part of it, and the Kathleen Turner production was there, and I thought probably not the best play to see on my honeymoon, so we...
I think not. No, yeah. That was an interesting choice.
Yeah, we opted to not see that, so we wound up seeing the stage version at another city a few years later, and yeah, it kind of, as much as we enjoyed supporting our friend, the play really bummed me out.
Yeah, and there's dumb stuff in it, too. There's some additional material, because they took, you know, the novel was pretty closely followed, but there's junky stuff in the novel along with some really good stuff, and there's junky stuff in the play. As I recall, the last scene is not on the bus. The last scene is Benjamin and Elaine in a motel room where she's starting to feel a little bit uneasy, and he cheers her up by giving her her favorite breakfast cereal. I mean,
yeah.
That's the end of the play. I'm sorry, spoiler alert. But they don't seem to really get these characters or understand where the impact of this film lay.
Yeah. Well, once again, Beverly Gray is the author of Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. She also has written Ron Howard, From Mayberry to the Moon, and Beyond, as well as Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers. Beverly, what else can we shamelessly plug for you?
Okay, thank you very much for the shameless plug. So. I would love to see people visit my website, which is Beverly Gray, that's GRAY.com, and I write twice weekly, without fail, a blog called Beverly in Movie Land, and I'm always happy to have people read it, comment if they'd like. Start a conversation. I'd love that. I write about movies, movie making, and growing up Hollywood adjacent. So I have a great deal of fun with that.
Well, we really appreciate your time, and cuckoo kajoo, Beverly Gray.
Thank you so much.
Author Beverly Gray, the writer of Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, here's some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz has spoken. Next week, we'll talk more about the films of Arlie Ermey as well as Milos Forman. But don't miss Lean on Pete, already one of the top films of the year, and it's only April. So go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Here's some music from Amadeus. It's Mozart's Symphony No. 25 in G minor, K183, first movement. Take care.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!